Well, Lynn Abraham, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
My pleasure to be here with you, Dave.
Other candidates in this race have to introduce themselves to voters. You don't really. I mean, you were a popular district attorney for nearly 20 years, but most of your career was in the criminal justice system. How do you make the case that you've got the knowledge and experience to tackle all the other issues a mayor must confront?
One of the things that the public may not know is that while I had a tremendous amount of experience in the criminal justice system, I also ran the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Philadelphia. I worked for City Council, and I'm an astute student of city governance. I have a wide range of interests and experience. So the notion that I can only do one thing is really a misplaced notion. So when I announced that I was running for mayor and held the public announcement, I think I demonstrated a wide command of the issues that are facing Philadelphia, and that resonates with the public. People are putting their trust and faith in an elected official. And while at any one time any elected official may not please everybody, because one has to make sometimes difficult, very, very tough decisions, the people have the sense, I think, about me that I'm going to make the right decision. They may not agree with it all the time. They may take issue with one thing or two. But I think they know that I'm always going to tell them the truth, and I'm going to present it in a way that is not only understandable but compassionate, and telling them that this is the right way to go. The one thing that the public knows about me is they know they will never see me in front of a grand jury or a petit jury on trial for anything whatsoever, from a ticket to anything else, up to whatever fantasy one might imagine. I'm a totally honest person and an honest elected official.
When you had your campaign announcement, you talked about modifying the way development happens in the city. What do you want to do?
Here's what I think needs to happen. First of all, I think we have to, although people don't really have a grasp on this, and I think that's part of the problem with city governance. Part of the things that I've been listening to is people say, why doesn't anybody ever explain to me what's going on? I don't know what's happening, and I don't understand it. And why don't they listen to us? The way we are doing a business now has been unacceptable. First and foremost, because the L&I function of Philadelphia is totally really out to lunch. They're in a state of almost collapse. Improperly supervised, improperly trained, and no accountability. Now the movement is to separate the inspection function and dump it on the fire department, bad move, and to sort of separate it, the whole system, which means just moving the deck chairs around. So first and foremost, you have to make sure that we have a functioning L&I department, which I will definitely take care of. In addition to that, people want to have development that is understandable to them. For example, most Philadelphia residents don't understand this 10-year tax abatement, and they don't get the benefit of it. They think it's for just the wealthy.
And let's just explain what it is.
A tax abatement is if you buy a brand new home, for example, the homeowner doesn't have to pay property taxes for 10 years.
That's for new construction.
For new construction.
Not an old home.
If you buy a row house that's a nice house, but it's not a brand new constructed house, you get no tax abatement. Whereas if I buy the house right next door to you, which was torn down and rebuilt, I get 10 years of tax abatement. People don't understand that. So, and I can understand their gripe. But more importantly than that is ordinary people who are not in that category to get the brand new construction because they can't fund it. I have suggested a 20-year tax abatement, which will do two things. Number one, it will inspire developers to build low and moderate income housing and housing for the elderly and the infirm in a community. The builder will get some tax consideration, and the homeowner or occupant will get a 20-year tax abatement. So this is for the low and moderate income people, not just the so-called well-to-do. So it spurs development. It makes a change in neighborhoods, and it encourages people who are of a certain socioeconomic level to say, hey, you know, the government isn't only for the rich and the powerful. I'm getting a break too.
But that would apply to new construction.
Oh, absolutely.
As well.
Okay. New construction.
So
absolutely.
If you're buying a rental,
a modern, for example, if you're buying a developed house, not a government subsidized house, Joe Developer says, I want to go in this community and build some houses for low and moderate income housing because the government subsidies are really way down on construction. So, but a developer wants to make a profit and he wants to build not in a very shishy neighborhood. He wants to turn the neighborhoods of our older areas around. But the owners maybe not be able to afford it. So if you can have a 20-year tax abatement where you forgive the taxes for 20 years for people in low and moderate income neighborhoods, they can afford the price and they get a 10-year tax abatement. So they can owner-occupy their own homes and have a benefit. So that's something I want to explore with developers to see if I can coax them into doing that. Also,
you're not talking about means testing. This would be for anybody who does that.
Well, anybody who has a falls into the category of out of the center city loop area, so to spur new development, new homes, and new construction for those people who would ordinarily not be able to afford their own homes.
So the logic is that a more generous abatement will encourage more development beyond the high-income areas.
Absolutely. And, I think people feel this is a real classism, that they're deprived. And to the extent that we are capable of doing this in the city and still not get ourselves into trouble, and there are lots of troubles that I know about already, we want to try to encourage people to say, look, Dave, it's really very simple. When I own my own home, I tend to take care of it. When I don't own my own home and have no interest in it and it's owned by somebody else, there may be the fact that the landlord doesn't want to take care of the property. I have no interest in taking care of it, so it's not mine. And there's always this push-me-pull-you between landlord and tenants. I would much prefer, to the extent possible, that as many people as can possibly afford it have their own home, a place of their own. That is really resonating with people in Philadelphia. They want to be homeowners.
I'm sure this was a debate that will emerge as the campaign unfolds. That is a long time to go without property tax revenue. Are you concerned about a hit to the schools, which really count on that money?
Well, I'll tell you, I said that to the extent possible. Obviously, we have many things that are going to impede that fruition of that idea. One is that the method of collection of property taxes needs to be enhanced. That means that everybody who owes has to pay. And if it means that we don't want to wait to the end of the year to collect that big glob of money and go without for the rest, we may do quarterly payments or half-yearly payments. I'd have to see what the income projections are. We know that, for example, our pension is well underwater to the tune of somewhere, depending on who is counting, between four to maybe $5.5-6 billion, a huge drain, which means that if you're paying into a pension program, the fact that we don't have enough money to do capital programs is prohibitive. It's just horrible. So we'd have to see how much money is really being taken in. How is our money being spent? How is our money being managed? And the good thing about me is that, first of all, in all these issues, I'm going to look at it with, as they say, a gimlet eye. I'm going to put on my glasses with a very, very tight spectrum of vision. I'm going to see, where's the money coming in? Where is it going out? How is it being managed? So there's an element of fearlessness in it. There's a courage to change the way we're doing business. And if we have to inflict some pain on people, there's going to have to be pain that's going to have to go around. You know, there's no Pollyanna view of life in cities any longer. But we have the capacity to change the way we do business.
You've talked about a terrible relationship that exists between this mayor and city council.
Isn't it obvious to everybody?
Can you do better?
Of course. And here's the difference. You know, even though I'm going to have my differences along the campaign trail, and already have, with Darrell Clark and his lack of leadership and the lack of leadership in city council with the UIL proposed sale
of PGW. You've publicly criticized him for that.
And not only do I publicly criticize him, I'm criticizing it on the air with you. Just the other day, there was a cartoon in the Daily News of the city council president leading a group of city council people who are blindfolded and have their mouths taped because nobody spoke up and said, listen, as I've said in my announcement, I'm not taking a position for or against this customer for PGW. But UIL, who comes to Philadelphia with $1.8 billion cash in hand, ought to be given the courtesy of a hearing and either up or down on the merits. If they have a plan that's a rotten plan, then it ought to be dismissed, chopped up, disregarded, and say, go away, you're not for real. Or if it has good points, they ought to be pointed out. If it has bad points, they ought to be pointed out. Give people with $2 billion in cash to give to the city of Philadelphia for an important asset a hearing. And let them prove that they have a good or bad plan, and then shoot it down if it's not good. Just don't say, oh, there isn't the vote for it. Who's the council president to say there isn't a vote for it? You know, he doesn't have the authority to say that. And it's disappointing to have the city council all stand there mute. It didn't serve them or the city of Philadelphia well. And the proof of the matter is Mr. Torgerson, the CEO of UIL, said, boy, it says a lot about who wants to come to Philadelphia to do business if this is the kind of treatment that you get.
You're committed to working more effectively and cooperatively with city council than the current mayor. And yet, you know, you've strongly criticized the current council president, who might very well be there if you're in office.
I don't believe so. And here's the reason why.
You don't think he's going to be there?
Oh, he might not love it. I mean, look, if I said to you, hey, Dave, your program is terrible and you're terrible, would you love it? No. However, you might say, you know, maybe I didn't conduct that interview the best I could. Or if you take every criticism as, okay, well, I'm not going to talk to her anymore, well, that's not very effective way of dealing with an issue. Council, I think, and the council president have been roundly criticized by everybody, except the other two candidates, so they don't want to criticize the other three. They haven't said a word about that.
About
I'm the only one who's talking about the council president and the council not having the chops to hold a hearing and to give the company an up or down vote based on the evidence that they put forward and the questions that are proposed by anybody, Public Utility Commission, Gas Works, citizens, seniors, unions, everybody gets a fair shake and criticizes and kills the deal or doesn't.
Fair enough.
But so here's the thing. If they deserve to be criticized, I'm not going to stand by and be quiet and say, oh, these are wonderful fellows and they did just the right thing. They know they didn't do right. These are not people lacking in intellect. They just made a choice that I think is unwise and I'm calling it on it. I'm not chastising.
Okay.
I'm not shaking my finger. I think that I'm just calling them out on something they should have had more guts to do. Having said that, you know, we're going to have our disagreements. That's the nature of governance. The executive branch and the legislative branch have our differences. It doesn't mean we can't work productively on a variety of problems and issues that face the general public. Look, we can't forget we represent the public. We're not representing ourselves.
Right. You do have a reputation for being plain spoken. There were times when you, as district attorney, got into some contentious exchanges on budget hearings with city council members. Just give me a sense
only one city council member, not city
and
council
it was Michael,
members.
It was Nutter.
Michael Nutter.
That's
he
right.
always wanted to,
okay.
Here we were drowning in blood in the city of Philadelphia, and he wanted to cut my budget and did. He made sure that I didn't get any money. He wasn't hurting me. He was hurting the citizens of Philadelphia who he professed to want to serve, many of them in his own councilmanic district who were being murdered. So if he thought he was punishing me, unfortunately, his belief was misplaced, and what happened was that we couldn't deliver the maximum amount of service to the people. But I will tell you this, the men and women of the district attorney's office, whether they got a raise or they didn't, whether there was more money to fight crime or there wasn't, they did the most magnificent job. These men and women really served the citizens of Philadelphia well.
Okay, I just want to come back to this. Why will you be better at dealing with counsel?
Because, you know, you have to have a willingness to sit down. Let me put it to you this way. I'll make it with sort of apples and oranges to make it easier. You know, when you go into – I'll use a tent. When you go into a tent, you generally speaking don't walk in standing straight up. There's a flap in the tent, and you have to be able to bend at the waist when you enter into somebody else's tent. I find nothing objectionable about bending to go into somebody's tent. Now, I'm not going to Simonize somebody's shoes, but I know how to bend at the waist, all right? And people have to also respect the mayor's authority too. I mean, this is a give and a take. And here's what I never lose sight of. In any office I've ever held, and there have been a lot of public offices where the public trusted me to do their work, I've always regarded my job as not a job for Lynn. I was serving the people of Philadelphia. I'm never going to stop serving them. It's not about my ego or your ego. Can we do something to help the citizens of Philadelphia deal with this issue? Do the streets have to cave in? Does your house have to fall down? Does somebody have to be killed? Does somebody have to not know where to get help from a city agency? When you call 311 and you get sent around all of Robin Hood's barn and you can't get a straight answer from anybody, aren't the members of the public entitled to real better service for their tax dollars than they're getting? Don't they deserve more? I think the answer is yes.
You've spoken about the need to fix the city schools. Every other candidate talks about it. Mm-hmm. You and I have seen for decades people of intelligence and goodwill try and fail to fix them.
Yep.
Do you have a new idea?
Well, I'll tell you something. I think I have several important ideas, some of which I'll share, some of which I won't. But I think that for many people who think that the school system is really being effectively dealt with, I sort of doubt it. I believe that the mayor and I in particular will get fully invested in the schools from the top to the bottom or from the bottom to the top and everywhere in between. I think that everything that goes on in that school building in North Broad Street, used to be the Inquirer's press room, has to be known. It can't be a secret archive of information that never gets out like a black box. Everything has to be accountable and accounted for. That is monies, how many employees, who's doing what, how we treat our teachers. And I have to tell you, Dave, I'm a product of Philadelphia's public schools. I owe my life to public school teachers.
But isn't all that information public? I mean, they're regularly audited by the city controller.
But it's not just the money. It's how the money is used and where does it go and how wisely is it spent. In addition to that, there are issues obviously between a disconnect, I think I could probably call it correctly, between the SRC and the school teachers, which you saw played out on our public streets just a few weeks ago when the SRC said, look, we're tired of negotiating with the teachers. The contract is at an end, and this is what we're doing, and now that's in court. That will, I hope, be resolved by the time if the voters have confidence in me and think that I can help solve these problems. I can't say solve them. And anybody who promises you as a candidate that they will solve the school problems in 4 years is either a liar or a scoundrel. It can't happen in 4 years. What you can do is try to right the ship so that it's pointing in at least the right direction. That means having due regard for teachers, venerating teachers, really, giving the kids guidance counselors, teaching them art, stop cutting arts and crafts and music and all those wonderful things that give kids things to think about and to dream about, better attention to technology, giving the teachers the supports that they need, and especially making sure that teachers not only have the supports and the respect of people, but also they have decent surroundings and they don't have to dip in their own pocket to buy children's school supplies.
All that costs money.
I understand that.
And do you have a source for it? Do you think that savings can be found in school operations?
Well,
People talk about that a lot. But not only
do I think there might be savings, but I think there needs to be the investment of the private sector. I do believe that parents and the private sector can have a great deal to do with saving our schools. I think a major investment by private industries, whether it's through apprentice programs or mentorships or getting totally involved, adopting a school. I think we also have to, and this is really important, we are spending millions and millions, untold millions, on schools that ought to be closed. In other words, we divide a school group of, let's say, 400 or 500 kids. We put 250 in this school, 250 in that school. When the school, one of those buildings, is suffering from major structural or heating or lighting or air conditioning issues, and we shouldn't be spending that kind of money to save a building which is going to be closed and sold off. We have to decide, even though they're painful, which building should be kept open and where to put school kids. In addition to that, I don't really think that we should continue to take kids out of their neighborhoods to take them in some other community or area.
Do you mean magnet schools?
No, not necessarily magnet schools, but I want to try to see if we can reshift the focus and have schools, if we can, be more centrally located to the communities in which they serve so that kids aren't shipped all over. Now, look, if there are charter schools too. Remember, there are a fair number of charter schools.
And do you like the idea of charter schools?
Well, I'm a CEO of a charter school in Reading, Pennsylvania. So I think there are some failures on some charter schools in Philadelphia. You've seen 3 or 4 of them close down or be in really difficult financial straits. There's a question in my mind whether or not, with the funding that charter schools get from the regular school system budget. First of all, there's not fair funding for all schools across Pennsylvania. And one of the major platforms that I'm going to pursue is fair funding across Pennsylvania for all of Pennsylvania's school kids, all of them, including Philadelphia. So as I am given to understand, when charter schools have money left over, if they have any left over, they can keep that money. They don't have to ship it back into the general fund, for want of a better term. So we have to find out how monies are being spent. And here's the most important part. one cannot hope to spend $12,000, it's about not quite $13,000, about $12,600 on a school child per year in Philadelphia, and expect to get the same product that you get in the suburbs, where a school district may spend $18,000, $20,000, or $22,000 per student per year. It just does not work. So there has to be a better funding formula so that every child, from the child from the most impoverished neighborhood to the child in the wealthiest neighborhood, gets fair funding for everybody so that each child has an equal chance of an education. Look, this city and this country will fail if we don't have kids who can take the technology jobs of today and tomorrow.
A couple other things. There's some buzz in political circles that you may struggle for African-American support because of your past as, you know, a crime-fighting DA and a penchant for seeking a reputation of someone who sought a lot of death penalty cases. And then there was that very public battle in 1998 when you opposed the federal nomination to the bench of an African-American Philadelphia mm-hmm. judge and created some hard feelings.
Well, let me just say this. First of all, if you know the African-American community like I do, they are the most put upon group in Philadelphia with regard to crime and criminality. And I can tell you that I've been invested most of my adult life in the African-American and other communities which are underserved. So people want to be safe. Everybody wants to be safe, whatever their skin tone, color, racial, ethnic, religious, or other background. And I've been absolutely equal with my attention to all of them. So if you understand that everybody, including African-Americans, since you made it, you are the one who made the question with regard to African-Americans, I can tell you, African-Americans are the most extraordinarily wonderful people. I've invested a tremendous amount of effort in giving them the service and attention that they rightfully deserve, A. B. With regard to the nomination of an African-American federal jurist to the federal bench, what you may not know is that every African-American judge before or since I have avidly supported back into the 80s, the first one being Judge Paul A. Dandridge, wonderful friend, terrific man, Ricardo Jackson to the federal bench, LaGrome Davis, Patrice Tucker. The one judge that I opposed was based on the record in court. It wasn't because of race or gender. Right. It was because of the record.
This was Frederica Messiah Jackson.
It was Judge Jackson.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's going to be an issue, and I don't know that she wants to be the issue of her campaign, but that opposition to her nomination was based on her judicial statements and her actions in court.
And being too lenient on criminals, you believe?
It wasn't that at all. What it was mostly it was the way she treated our police officers and our prosecutors. Her demeanor and her statements on the bench, which were on the record, and I presented that record for all to see. But I think, as sometimes happens, things get swept up in an emotional situation, and there was a lot of attention. However, I can tell you this, that to this day, I support people or not based on anything other than their qualifications, their merit, and on no other quality. It's not about gender identity, sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, economic status, neighborhood, or anything else. So I intend to wage a vigorous campaign. And if this issue comes up, it'll come up.
Okay.
And I'll deal with it.
All right. With the greatest respect, I want to raise the delicate matter of your age.
Mm-hmm. It's not delicate at all. I take ownership of it.
Terrific. I want to just say for our audience, I mean, I've seen you a few times since you began this campaign, and I will attest that you seem to be in robust health and have enormous energy. That said, I mean, if you win the election, you will, I believe, turn 75 the month that you take office.
Yep.
It's a tough, stressful, demanding job.
So what?
Any concern that you could give it what it needs for 4 years?
No. Now, I'll tell you, if I thought, and here's the thing, this is not an ego trip for me, Dave. I don't need this. This is hard work. This is not for gain of another job. I'm not looking to be the governor or the president or a senator or a congressman. This is my entire attention and devotion is to the city. And I have all the energy to devote it entirely to the city. So I take ownership of my age. But here's what I think about age. It's the depth and breadth and scope of my experience, my courage, my determination, my vision, and the fact that I know how to get things done. That's what the city wants. Now, just take a look at it from the other side. And I owned every one of these gray hairs, and if you'll notice, I don't color my hair. I have never colored my hair. I've had gray hair since I was maybe 20. So people look at me and they go, gee, you're ageless. I'm saying, no, I'm not ageless. I just look that way because I've always had gray hair. And I have old photographs of me. I just have more gray hair as opposed to a little less. But I am possessed of a tremendous amount of energy. I take no meds whatsoever. I have no health issues whatsoever. And I want to also point out that Senator Arlen Specter was elected when he was in his late 70s or even early 80s. Frank Lautenberg, Jerry Brown, the governor of California, just was sworn in. I think he's 76 or 77. Nobody cared about his age. Dianne Feinstein. Hillary Clinton, who's running for president, is going to be just a few years younger than I. Nobody's saying, oh, Hillary, you're too old. No, no. This is not a matter of ageism, although I can tell you as a statement of fact, women's ages and men's ages are treated differently. So if I were a man, they'd say, oh, well, she's so experienced and she has a depth of and a wealth of background. But women are treated differently than men. I accept that. I don't shun it. But I can tell you I'm going to run rings around every one of my opponents insofar as stamina is concerned. And I have the strength and the determination and the drive to get the job done.
Fair enough. I just want to say for the record that I asked the very same question of Frank Rizzo Jr. when he was talking about running for mayor.
No. Yeah. Remember, I'm not defensive about it. I'm owning it.
I just want to say aware that there's a concern that some people will see that as a gender-biased issue. I bring it up because I think it's something that some people will wonder about.
They don't even have to bring it up. It's sort of an unspoken thing. So that's why I'm not afraid or ashamed or reticent about addressing, because it is what it is. It's part of who I am. And that's why if you try to run away from it, it's silly. I stand up and deliver on that and other issues. And you've known me for a long time, so you've always known I've always been the same.
You've never been afraid to answer a question. I know that. What's your view about the changes in enforcement policy on small amounts of marijuana?
Well, that's not an easy thing to discuss. However, let me just say this. While I was district attorney, nobody went to prison for possession of small amounts of marijuana. They were either given a citation or they were put in a diversionary program, and sometimes the case wasn't even approved for prosecution. So let me repeat that. Nobody ever went to prison for possession of a small amount of marijuana, which means like butts or ends or an ounce or less. Nobody. Now, if you had a criminal record for robbery, burglary, murder, and something else, and you were out and this was a probation violation, well, that's too bad. But just for possession, no. We had diversionary programs. We had juvenile drug court. We had adult drug court. Second part, I am concerned about the medical use of marijuana. I believe that many botanicals do have medicinal qualities. And I understand there are some, but not yet complete, information done by medical scientists that there are certain aspects of the cannabis, THC and so forth, which may have pain or other qualities. I'm all in favor of any kind of use of any kind of botanical, including marijuana, for glaucoma or pain or nausea or anything like that. So that's the other part of it. The third part of it is marijuana smoked by juveniles. I think this is very bad. It's not retro. It's bad. All of the medical literature shows, all of it shows that when young people smoke a lot of marijuana because it's allowed, there's no penalty for it anymore, the danger is that it affects their development of their brains and affects their full mental and emotional capacities. The New England Journal of Medicine has come out with it. The Lancet Medical Journal has come out about the heavy use of marijuana, let alone, and remember, kids are also taking a tremendous amount of medicine that they find in their parents' and grandparents' medicine cabinets and synthetic drugs and all kinds of other things. So we have a drug problem in this country. As for adults who smoke marijuana alone, I think it's stupid, but I don't know if it's any better than alcohol. Look at wonderful things that alcohol has done for our society. Drunken drivers, hit-and-run accidents, a homicide on the highway by people who are DUI, meaning under the influence of alcohol or drugs, including marijuana. I mean, so it has to. It can't be just sort of a. I think the problem, the way you frame the question, is that one size fits all. One size doesn't fit all. So do I think that marijuana may be legalized across the country? Yeah. Do I think we're going to pay a heavy price for it? Oh, absolutely. We just want to be so she-she. I mean, you know, I don't think it's grown up to want the country to smoke marijuana. And frankly, Dave, if you were the manager of this company and any one of your on-air personalities came in stoned on a regular basis on marijuana, you'd fire them. I mean, it is what it is. So, I mean, I know it's going to happen. That doesn't mean that I have to sign on to it. There are certain things that I won't sign on to. Medical use, absolutely. Show me the medical proof, and I'm for it. Adults, whole different story, but there's a price to pay for that. Juveniles, a bigger price to pay in how your brain and thoughts and emotions develop. And just recreational use because it's fun, it's not a good thing.
Before I let you go, I want to come back to one more specific question about schools. I'm wondering what you think of the fact that the current mayor, when the state was unable or unwilling to provide additional funding for the schools, turned to Philadelphia taxpayers for a series of property tax increases, a sales tax increase, and a brand new cigarette tax. Was that wise? Were there alternatives?
Well, I will say this, that our taxes for our property tax, a large chunk of it goes to the schools. The problem is that I'm not so sure that we're, again, concentrating where we ought to. I'll give you an example. The latest issue, the cigarette tax, I think was a bad move for this reason. Number one, it wasn't statewide, and the state legislature was not going to grant a statewide tax on cigarettes. So Philadelphia tailored it for cities of the first class, of which Philadelphia is the only
one. It's the only one in the state.
So now, and I don't support smoking. Just so you know, I'm anti-smoking because my father died of lung cancer and my sister has lung cancer from smoking. And I banned smoking in the DA's office because I said, you cannot smoke in this office. It's unhealthy for you and it's unhealthy for everybody else. So having said that, so you know where I'm coming from, to go to the state and say, okay, we want a cigarette tax, which imposes a $2 tax on cigarettes, is good for people because it'll stop people from smoking. It will not get taxes to save our schools. In addition to that, people are in Philadelphia are going across the street to Montgomery County if they live on City Line, or they'll drive across the Delaware to go into New Jersey, or they'll go into Montgomery County or Delaware County or Bucks County. In fact, friends of mine in the Northeast, they just go right down State Road to Bucks County in Bensalem, and they buy all their cigarettes at the Wawa in Bensalem instead of the Wawa in Philadelphia. So what does that solve? It doesn't solve really the problem that we need is a dedicated funding source to help our schools succeed. So we have it. Let's see what that amount is. They said it would bring in $80 million. I seriously doubt it's going to bring in $80 million, and we'll see how much it brings in. I'll be happy if it brings in any millions. Don't misunderstand me. But it's not going to reach the level that we need to reach. And one other thing, it's my considered judgment that the legislature is shifting its gaze away from Philadelphia. We're losing our center of gravity, so to speak, because the House and
we
Senate—
We have fewer influential
yes,
politicians
yes,
than we used.
For a
no
whole
doubt.
Variety of reasons. And I think that it's going to be a harder sell to go to Harrisburg again, especially since Harrisburg has its own $2 billion budget deficit. But I think it will be better if the mayor and city council go together than if they go separately, no matter what we ask for. That's my intent, to go with the city council president and anybody else we need
yeah,
to
I was
get
gonna say,
assistance.
I was just going to say, I mean, fair funding for schools is something that a lot of people in Philadelphia want. And it just
everybody wants it across Pennsylvania.
And it seems it's going to be hard to get with this legislature.
It very well might. But, you know, this is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. This is an issue for every child of every description from our western border to our eastern border, our northern border, and our southern border. Every child deserves the building blocks of a first-class education, the kind that I had in Philadelphia public schools for my entire kindergarten through 12th grade education. That's what really saved my life, a first-class quality education in the public schools.
Lynn Abraham, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.